My name is Libby Bishop, and I work on the Timescapes project and have since about 2007. And my primary role on that project is the archivist. Now, that's a bit ironic, as I actually don't have formal archive training, but we can go into another tangent on time and career, interesting career trajectories if you want. My background is social science, largely sociology and economics. But prior to coming to Timescapes, I have worked at the UK Data Archive, which I mentioned at least some of you know of or have worked with. And within the UK Data Archive, almost exclusively focused within the unit called Qualidata, which, as its name suggests, works with the archiving and sharing of qualitative data. So you can see a bit of a connection and trajectory there. So I guess I'm going to try to accomplish several different things today. I will go through some background to the Timescapes archive, and as Bren described, this Timescapes project has created quite a large collection of data that is being archived, both in its own repository at Leeds and also copied and preserved at the UK Data Archive. But in some sense, I'm using that as a case or an illustration to bring out a number of other issues around data archiving and data sharing, which we'll come to, and in particular, the role of how to balance sort of multiple competing issues or ethical issues, if you will, in the sharing and archiving of data, and that will arise as we go through things today. The other aspect is the archive is being created for all of, with the primary intent, if you will, that it will get reused. We certainly aren't going through all the work, time, money, and expense to preserve and protect this data in just locking it away in what might be called a dark archive. The idea is that it is going to be available for reuse. So I'll spend a little bit of time also talking about issues of reusing data, in particular qualitative data, and also some examples and challenges within that. So in some sense, we're a bit using Timescapes as an example to think around these issues, around ethics and around reusing data. And I hope that will become clearer as we go through. So I think you've already got a pretty good sense of the Timescapes project. I won't go into much more detail, but it does cover these broad ranges of topics, relationships, identity, family life, care and support. This key idea that these sorts of relationships, personal relationships, are extremely important in people's lives. It sounds obvious, and yet there is a whole other line of argument, if you will, about the growing individualization and atomization of the world. And yet, even in the face of that, Timescapes is taking a research stance, if you will, that families and personal relationships remain central in people's lives, and is finding evidence much to support that idea. Just to say a bit more about the specific projects, Bren mentioned a couple of them, but to be clear that although allowing for a couple of our legacy projects, I think our earliest data in a sense goes back to the late mid-90s, early 90s, the inventing of adulthoods. So we do have by now a fairly good span of upwards of or 10 years or a bit more of data. Timescapes itself is longitudinal. It ran or is running these 5 years from 07 to 12. But we've also, in a sense, structured cohorts into the design of the projects. So two projects focus on young people, sibling relationships, and teen to adult transitions. Three projects focus on midlife, if you will, one on motherhood, one on fatherhood, one on work-life balance challenges, and two projects explicitly on older life, as Bren has mentioned both of those. But why I do want to raise this topic, because many people have sort of the same initial pause, if you will, about reusing data or about reusing qualitative data in particular, about who on earth would do such a thing. It sort of comes on the, would you really serve leftovers to the guests? You know, it kind of has that slightly unsavory idea that you might not really do it. Well, you might not recognize all the names on the slide, but I imagine you recognize at least one or two of them. And essentially, of course, I tried to pick out big famous names in our world who you might know. So Mike Savage, formerly here, now at York, doing interesting work on class and class identity. Vanessa May's excellent work on motherhood. Dawn and Graham's work I know relatively well. I've worked with Dawn at Essex a bit, revisiting Ray Powell's work studying SHEPI and employment issues and young people's lives and young people's imagined futures. Just to make the point, a lot of people actually are doing this. It is even growing in publications. You'll begin to see it. There's a special issue of the International Journal of Social Research Methodology coming out on it, and a number of other special issues as well. And not only are people doing it, but the ESRC is funding it, which was probably equally important to know about. You may well know a new funding call is coming out on secondary analysis, probably to be formally announced even later this week. And from a previous call, Julia Brannon at the Institute of Education is doing a project which is exclusively using, I believe it's going to exclusively use secondary data, which is still a bit unusual, looking at a whole range of existing data for a focused study on family food and meal practices. So there's quite a bit going on in that world. Well, what are the benefits of reusing data? And I'm going to skip over a number of them, actually, if you will. There is a huge debate, actually, in this area, and we can come back to this in Q&A. There are some important arguments happening kind of at the public policy level, if you will. There's a debate about whether or not the data are, in fact, a public good. Is there a public duty to or researcher responsibility to do this? Is it good value for money to reuse data? I partially agree with a lot of those arguments, but I actually believe the stronger arguments for reusing data have to do with benefits to participants themselves and, in fact, to research and the quality of research. So we can have the debate about value for money or whatnot, if you will, but that's actually not where I prefer to ground it. I think it's more important to focus on the issues of the benefits of reusing data to ourselves as researchers and the research community. So one very, very important thing it does is prevent unneeded data collection. And I don't know, maybe it's the circles I go in, maybe I go to the wrong conferences, but I certainly have sat through way too many presentations of badly designed small sample studies where absolutely nothing new is told, and there are a handful of cherry-picked quotes that are supposed to prove something to me, and I'm really tired of it because I think it's bad research and doesn't do our discipline, the broader discipline, if you will, of qualitative inquiry, any good whatsoever. So that there's a place for, no offense, all of us are still students. Some of us are currently officially students. Certainly all of us are still students in the sense of learning. There's a place to do small scale, very modest, nothing particularly innovative by way of research, as training wheels. This is what everyone has to do to learn how to do the task. But beyond that, you know, if you're still doing that 5-10 years beyond your PhD, you just shouldn't be. You should be doing something more innovative. At least I think we should aspire to doing that. Qualitative research is particularly good for working with vulnerable populations, the ill, the elderly, infirm, excluded, all these kinds of populations. But some of these communities, we well know, are seriously being over-researched. They're really tired of having the same new generations of researchers knocking on the door going, "Hi, I know you're socially excluded. Would you talk to me, please?" We have a lot of information about these populations now. We don't really need to ask them the same. And tell me, and how many generations of your family has been unemployed? We don't need to ask these same questions quite the same way. We should be doing something different. And I think what we should be doing more of is, as Bryn said, think about good research questions. There are so few in the world. It's really shocking. It is truly amazing. Read Jennifer Mason's book on designing qualitative. It's nothing but questions. And the first time I read the book, I was so angry because I admire Jennifer so much. I really wanted answers. And I thought, drat, why did you just write this book on it? That's all questions. But it is the best book of questions that you will ever read. So think hard about questions. Think about causal mechanisms, not in just the sort of positivistic, narrow A causes B, but real deep underlying mechanisms of what's going on. We should be spending much more time on that. We claim that's what qualitative work allows us to do. We don't actually spend enough time focusing on that. Innovating with our methods, innovating with theory, these are things that I think we should be spending more time doing. So yeah, I would, time and place, but you can be even innovative about mixing up different data sets. Your kind of question about even questions about thinking about a longitudinal dimension as to what had been considered primarily cross-sectional work. These are modest scale good ways of developing innovation. So, but we can come back to that at the end also. So ways of reusing data. The language here is actually kind of interesting. This original language, if you will, always referred to work around calling secondary analysis. That's apt. It works fairly well. It makes a useful distinction with primary analysis. it does get a bit muddled because sometimes the line between primary and secondary becomes gray, as it often things do with qualitative work. Also, the boundaries blur. If our timescapes researchers, if we come back to our work in 5 or 10 years looking more or less at the same data, is that secondary because we've come back to it, or is it primary because we collected it and it's more or less the same thing? With longitudinal work, these boundaries blur a bit. And the other major issue, really, probably more significant, is secondary does exactly have that, you know, implication of the poor cousin, the poor relation. Is it secondary in the sense of second tier quality, lower quality, anything like that? So reusing, I rather like the term reusing because for me it sort of fits into a reuse, recycle, ecological framework. I kind of put it in the same category as, you know, I do serve leftovers to companies, so you can think about that if I ever invite you to my house for dinner. But so I rather like this idea about reusing data. But somebody gave me this interesting framework that reusing is this broad category. Secondary analysis might refer to specifically the kind of analytic work that we are analytic techniques of reusing data. Then there are other ways of reusing data, such as for teaching, such as for doing in-depth work on methods, which isn't strictly speaking secondary analysis, but it certainly is reusing data. But what do? Well, we ask new questions of existing data. I'll give you some examples earlier on, but just they can come from anywhere. A fantastic oral history project done by Paul Thompson that a number of you might know about called The Edwardians has been reused for lots of different things, but despite the fact that it seems to have tried to cover nearly every topic under the sun, from families to education to work to religion to leisure, nobody had actually specifically asked questions about smoking. Well, somebody went back and looked at the data for studies of smoking. There's actually a lot in there about incidental mentions of smoking, which was quite useful for research purposes. So we can ask these new questions. Excellent for comparative work across time, across locations, as Bren said, working across these, bringing any kind of comparative dimension into your work is often extremely helpful. One thing that I often talk to, in fact, I'm one of the PhD students, master student now working on her thesis, who works at Qualidata, wants to reuse some of Qualidata's materials. And I'm encouraged, a lot of people in this position are encouraged to do a bit of both. Obviously, working through master's or PhD is a critical time to do your own data collection. I would never suggest that people go all the way through qualitative or methods work and not collect their own data. There's a time and place you really must learn those skills. But it's interesting to think about how you might combine that with some data from existing sources, so that can be useful. Other ways, again, as I've mentioned, you can just think of it almost as in-depth literature review. It's literature review plus data, and that can give you much deeper understanding into methods and historical background than you might have gotten otherwise. And increasingly, it's being used for teaching. This lecturer I know at Bristol named Joe Haynes has been reusing about 10 of the case studies or the data collections at Qualidata for teaching her MA postgraduate classes. And being extremely successful with that, and a number of others are doing so as well. So what are the ways? We actually had a whole secondary analysis strand built into Timescapes as well, and I should step back and draw on the fact that it is significant that Timescapes had these three they were very linked, but autonomous strands moving through it, which was the whole sequence and batch of the research projects. The archiving work was a second strand, and we also had a whole distinct project on secondary analysis. So we were doing all those things almost literally at the same time during the project. So what did we do in terms of reusing data sort of within the scope of the Timescapes work? Well, we bridged external data sets, and I think and Bren might have mentioned that, I will come back to it later, but we did that in a number of ways. We collected some quantitative data to make our data set comparable with some of the big quantitative data sets like British Household Panel Study and the National Child Development Survey. We don't have every variable, obviously, in those data sets because they're vast, but we've got a little bit that gives you some basis for comparability. And as you might imagine, some of the projects within Timescapes quite well lent themselves to comparative work. So the two projects that involved grandparenting had some comparative work going on. They were working with quite different kinds of samples, one very young grandparents and the oldest generation with this minimum age of 75 years old. Nonetheless, issues of grandparenting came out in the two projects. We did structure in a handful of questions, what we call our common questions, trying to make sure everybody in the sample got asked these same questions. Now, that was very difficult from the standpoint of asking a question about, say, turning points in this case to, you know, a teenager, age 15, dealing with school issues, and then asking that at somebody, I don't know, it's 85 years old, dealing with a transition into care home. How do you actually ask that question in the same way to get comparable answers? That was a big challenge for Timescapes. Nonetheless, we do have evidence about this idea of transitions or turning points for people across the life course, if you will, at these various ages. In some cases, we deepened extended the Timescapes research questions by adding an additional dimension of gender. So in one of the Young Lives projects, looking at young people's expectations and hopes about education and higher education, one of the secondary analysis team went back and looked in close detail about the gendering of that decision and came up with important new findings. And methodological challenges of secondary analysis, which are quite big. There is, again, a whole other side debate on reusing data about the role of context. Broadly speaking, in a lot of qualitative work, if you think that qualitative work or qualitative data is, you can't separate it from its context, if you will. It's created interactionally with the researcher. It's part and parcel of the event and situation. What if someone's going to come to reuse the Timescapes data? What contextual information by way of documentation can we provide to help researchers use that material? And we are creating quite a bit. We would never say that we can recreate all the context, but we're trying to create enough that people will understand how the material was used the first time. You will certainly not be able to read this. I don't expect that. It's not that the details aren't relevant. But Bren mentioned our affiliates, and this is significant because, firstly, there are 17 of them here, and these are the funded ones, I think, that we've got now. Right. So these are the projects that weren't funded under the original Timescapes umbrella at all, but significantly, they want to join with us, if you will. They want to pool their data with us, and they are really, many of them are on the same kinds of themes as the Timescapes data, family, personal relationships, but some are linked only by methods, if you will, QL methodology, and concern very different topics, transportation studies, for example. But again, what is significant is that people see the benefit of this sort of sometimes on the thematic common themes, but certainly across the methodology of looking at QL methods. But also the idea of linking these data sets does become quite important, and we have a number of them, including some people who have actually gotten funded to help prepare their data for the archive, which is doubly significant. So back to some of the Timescapes data, again, not to give you any detail, but just to point out across the projects, lots of different waves, and the projects varied quite a bit in terms of their sampling. So some are national, given that they're qualitative, very few of the projects were really struggling to do statistical kind of representativeness, but in some sense they are attempting a national range or diversity, usually a bit more geographically or temporally focused than that. But it is a quite good range with the numbers of waves of data and geographic range. Bren's already given you some of the samples of data, and I'll do that a bit more in the archive demo, but just once you get into the archive, this is the kind of interface you would see. So you have an example of a case, this young woman named Chelsea from the Young Lives and Times project, and you see the fact that, you see her structured as a case, you know that this is her first interview of wave two, and she produced a variety of different kinds of data as linked with this interview, from relational maps, portraits, various kinds of timelines, faces, diagrams, family, and then also this When I'm 25 essay. And Bren gave you a number of examples of those kinds of essays. Yes, and just then to be clear, yes, at the moment, the images that you're seeing here, the data in the archive, it's sitting on a special kind of archiving repository software called Digital. You don't need to know that to use the archive, but that's what it is running at the Leeds repository. It's different stuff at the UK Data Archive. I can tell you more about it if you're interested. So this is a rather busy slide. It's only making a point. This is one of the little essays captured from the National Child Development Survey. So that idea of an essay of a young person writing what their life will be like when they're 25 years old, this was done with the NCDS sample, and this is one from the 1958 cohort. So you can compare those essays with the kind of essays that have been collected in Young Lives Myth, and also in both of the young person's projects within Timescapes, the Siblings Project and the Young Lives Project. So I found it amusing that our young man here in 1958 is interested in the Army, rugby, football on holiday, and lots of sport. And our young man, still at age 15 in 2011, or no, a little bit earlier, probably 9 or 10, is still interested in football, the Army, or being a Formula One driver. So some things do have a great deal of continuity in terms of future expectations. So the ethics of reusing data. Again, this is sort of just to flag up the issues, which I imagine we might return to in Q&A. But I will say briefly that the ethical use of data involves good planning and consideration and taking things into account from ideally from the start of the research project, which is one major advantage that Timescapes had. We knew we were going to be archiving from the very beginning. We put into practice consent procedures, anonymizing procedures, and whatnot from the very beginning, knowing that this was going to be the case. So generally speaking, and this is now pretty much true across the board, there are a number of qualitative archives across the world now, actually, and following similar practices, drawing on these three strategies, if you will, of gaining consent for the archiving of the data. That is, you don't ask for consent just for the research engagement or just for your publications or research outputs, but you also have the discussion about consent for future uses of the data during the course of the initial project. There are also then ways if you need to deal with confidentiality or anonymization, and most do, although there's an ongoing debate, if you will, across things like oral history and sociology as to levels of anonymization. Most times in most qualitative archives, data is anonymized. But data obviously are very, very greatly in their suitability for anonymization. And image data, audio data are damaged. The quality of that will be damaged usually by extensive anonymization. And the reuse potential is restricted greatly if you do a lot of face blurring or bleeping out of words within audio. So the remaining strategy is limiting access to the archive. Now this is complicated because in principle, you want the material to be accessible. We're trying to make it as open as possible. And yet, some of the data is sensitive. Some of the data exposes family issues, exposes people potentially to harm, and it needs to be regulated and controlled through limited access. And that's what the Timescapes Archive does, and that's what the UK Data Archive does as well. So when people put data into the archive, none of these archives are public. It's a quite important thing to be clear about, and a lot of people still believe that if you just Google, certain data will appear from the UK Data Archive. It's just not true. It doesn't happen. You have to register. You have to give away a goodly number of personal details, actually. You sign a rather daunting user license about things that you will not do to the data, namely you won't disclose identities, you won't use it for commercial use, you won't share it. And things, of course, that you will do, which is use it ethically, and those restrictions are in place across both archives. But you can go further, so that's sort of a standard registration procedure. For highly sensitive data, sometimes it needs tighter restrictions, and it will be made available only on what we call a case-by-case basis. So the depositors actually have to give permission. They find out who wants to use the data, they find out why they want to use it, and they can say yes or no. They know the data best, they can evaluate the prospective use. And in this way, you can actually share a fair bit of qualitative data that would not be shareable otherwise. So these are the levels of access. I should have shown this to make it a bit clear. So Timescapes has some data that's public, actually a small amount. Most of the data sits behind this registration scheme for registered users. Small amounts are available on case by case. And some of it is sitting under embargo. It's got a life of its own. And that can be short-term embargo, which typically is involving things like making sure that our early career researchers can get their publications out before exposing the data too broadly. In other cases, it might be some very sensitive data of young people, and we want to make sure that they get to age 16 or 18 or sort of an age of maturity to make certain decisions about releasing that data from embargo. So those are the criteria there. So I hope that is a bit of a whirlwind, but gives you an overview of the Timescapes archive. There's a lot more data still coming in. When I show you I don't want anybody to get the wrong idea. If you go look at the archive now, there's a lot of data in it, but there's a lot more yet still to come in. So don't be disappointed if you don't find everything there yet. And there's a lot of data at the UK Data Archive under Qualidata as well, both qualitative and quant. So if you have never had a look, you might want to, because there's plenty there to work with.